for the week of August 16th, 2015. This is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 290, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Birmingham, Alabama, I'm Michael Giltz.
Are you really in Birmingham?
I am. For the next few weeks.
I did not know you were going to Birmingham.
I'll let you know next time.
That sounds like the name of a future Harper Lee novel. And that's it. We have nothing else to discuss.
Of course we do. Plenty always happens in entertainment.
That's true.
So on this week's show, what will people hear about?
Okay, well, on this week's show, I quite honestly, Michael, you're in Birmingham. I don't know where Nick Winters is, but I really feel like we should ask the legendary lounge singer Nick Winters to swing on by to sing us, you know, the version of that hit song Star Wars that he always...
Nick Winters?
Yeah, Nick, you don't know who Nick Winters is? You know, just in case our audience doesn't know either, let me just play a little bit of our, not enough to get us sued, but enough for people to understand. Hold on, here he is in 1977.
Star Wars, nothing but Star.
That's fair use. Stop right there.
Exactly. Now, of course, that was Bill Murray in 1977. Yes. He was playing Nick Winters, the fictitious lounge singer he made famous at Second City and then on Saturday Night Live. But given all the Star Wars news we're going to be filling you in on from Disney's D23 convention, their version of Comic-Con, which occurred over the weekend, you'll swear we're taking that song to heart. Now, last week, we told you about how the movie studio Relativity Media had fallen on hard times and filed for bankruptcy. And this week, it looks as if SFX Entertainment, the big concert promoter, may be headed in the same direction if they can't find a buyer by October. Heck, we'll even tell you about a new adaptation of Shakespeare's King Lear that opened in London starring just one actor and nine sheep. I'm tempted, by the way, Michael, and you know that a pun has to be around the corner, but I'm tempted to make a pun here about how it opened to bad reviews.
Resist the temptation.
Okay. Yeah, I'll resist the temptation. In any case, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines from the rest of the week. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office. We're trying to make this show go faster because I'm really talking very, very fast.
That's not necessary. We just don't have to talk a lot.
Oh.
All right. We're talking about the worldwide box office. And of course, we're getting our information from RentTrak. We have a link in our show notes. And the number one movie around the world is Tom Cruise's Mission Impossible Rogue Nation. Another $63 million worldwide. It's at $375 million and counting. It looks like it's on par to match basically the grosses of the last film, Ghost Protocol. So that is good news for the franchise. At number two around the world is the biggest movie in North America. It's Straight Outta Compton, the biopic about NWA, the rap group. It grossed $56 million in North America and another $15,000 in Trinidad. Or so it opened on like a few islands somewhere and it grossed $15,000. Hopefully it will do much better down the road overseas. But this was the big story at the box office. As always, when there's a film with a black subject or a predominantly black cast, they underestimate the audience.
Yeah, I don't know why, because this one had lots and lots of publicity going into the movie, and everybody knew, you know, this movie was being released, and it's about a very popular music artist.
Group.
You're right. I was saying music artist kind of like using artist as the umbrella for all of the members of the band, but yes, I mean, this rap group is very well known.
That's right. And but as all you know, the studio wanted to manage expectations. They didn't want to overhype it because they don't want to fall. But, you know, you don't want to create a problem by saying it's going to make 80 million, you know. So they tried, well, it's going to make 25 million. And in fact, of course, we all knew it would make 40 to 50, but it outperformed that. It had really strong legs over the weekend. Great reviews, good audience score. So it's at $56 million. It's going to have a good long run. We'll have to see where it ends up. And how much it does overseas. That'll be the real interesting story here. But of course...
Well, NWA is very, very popular in Europe and Asia and elsewhere. So I don't necessarily see this being something...
How do you know NWA is really, really popular in Asia?
You know, actually...
You know their album sales in Asia?
You can thank Jim Jarmusch for that. Actually, the reason I know that is because of Jim Jarmusch and his, of course, now I can't remember the name of the movie that he did. It was in Cannes and NWA. I knew you were going to ask me something like that, and I knew I should.
I almost asked you how you knew Bill Murray did that character at Second City and not just on Saturday Night Live, but I assumed you knew that too.
Yes, research, actually. That was me trying to find.
Well done.
I was trying to find that. particular clip, and I found a whole bunch of clips of him doing that character at Second City. Ghost Dog is the name of the film in which NWA participates, and it was about samurais and
what?
Yeah, and
that score is not by NWA.
I believe he was in it.
Who? Oh, Ice Cube, Eazy-E. Dr. Dre, DJ Yella, MC Ren, who was in Ghost Dog?
You see, now you're going to make me look very unknowledgeable, but I remember doing the interviews for this film. And,
I'm just asking, who was in it?
Forest Whitaker, who had nothing to
No, you said... Besides, NWA is more important than it is big selling it, and their biggest album, Straight Outta Compton, just went double platinum in North America. It sold 3.5 million copies. That's what it says on Wikipedia. And their second album, Niggas for Life, sold 2 million copies. It doesn't have any references
RZA,
to overseas.
RZA, actually.
Yes, he's from Wu-Tang. He's not from NWA.
Can we start recording over again?
No, we cannot. Oh. All right.
I got those two confused. I'm sorry.
Well, that's because you're racist. So,
my God. I'm racist. What about like all of the LAPD, which spent their weekend at the movie theater making sure there were no shootings at any of the screenings of Straight Outta Compton?
The studio offered to pay for extra security for the audiences seeing the movie over the weekend. They were going to help any theaters that wanted to have extra ratings because, of course, black people can't go watch a movie without shooting each other.
That's right.
Wait a second. What was the last movie where there was a shooting? Oh, that's right. Trainwreck.
Yes, that's right. From now on.
Schumer. I forgot she was a sister.
Yeah, that's right. From now on, any Amy Schumer movie, they have to pay for extra security. We should write a law. Make a law.
What was the last movie before that where there was a shooting? I mean, I can think of Dark Knight, but wasn't there something since then? There was. A stabbing, a shooting, a this, a that.
Oh my gosh, there seems to be so many of them these days.
Yeah. So the idea that Straight Outta Compton suddenly was a security threat is absurd.
Yeah, well, look, I just want to know, am I the only one that confuses NWA with Wu-Tang all the time?
Yes, they're from different decades, practically.
No, they're both from the 90s.
No, what are you talking
about? Okay, Wu-Tang was kind of from the 80s and 90s.
Anyway, don't talk about rap, and let's talk about the movie, which
that's
comes
it.
From
I'm gonna take a course, maybe
it
two.
It comes from Universal, and that is the other big story here, isn't it? They're having the year to end all years. Universal has set worldwide box office record. Now they've reached $2 billion in North America faster than any other studio in history. The first one to do it was Warner Brothers. It took them till December 25th. And these guys have done it in August, and they still have more movies to go.
That's why I don't know why Universal had to manage expectations. If this movie tanked, all they had to say was, hey, Jurassic World.
That's right.
Just look, $2 billion.
They've got lots of movies.
Yeah, no.
Not
I mean,
just Jurassic World. That's the whole point.
Yeah. Yes, correct.
They're opening up every type of movie well, aren't they? They're having a terrific year.
Except for Ted, of course. I don't know why, but yeah, Ted is not there.
Nobody bats 1,000.
Yeah, that's true. Not even baseball players, by the way.
That's right.
That was a joke because you see that's, by the way. Enter the Wu-Tang, 1992, my friend.
Yes, and NWA is all in the 80s. They broke up practically before the 90s began. They didn't exist, practically. I mean, they got together for reunions, but their two albums came out in the 80s, not in the 90s.
Okay.
They're an 80s band.
Well, Michael, as you once told me, and I think this was recent when we were talking about spam, you said you learn something new every day. And
but apparently not by listening to this show where Sperling tells you things that are wrong.
Well, except that now you were able to correct me, thus informing our listeners a lot more about the fact that Wu-Tang and NWA are not the same rap group.
So this movie is a big smash hit out of the gate. We'll have to see how it does overseas. I don't know them as a force whatsoever in world, you know, in album sales around the world, but they're certainly a well-known, influential landmark group. Man from U.N.C.L.E., of course, was a big hit TV series from the 60s, a sort of a vague James Bond type series. That opened to $25 million worldwide. Not great news here in North America. Not great news overseas. We'll have to see where it ends up. It costs like $75, $80 million to make. So, you know, but not a good starting point for this movie. And number four, another movie that's in trouble is The Fantastic Four. Another $25 million. It passes the $100 million mark, but that's certainly nowhere near what Fox had hopes for the movie, at least when they launched the project.
Can we just go back to Man from U.N.C.L.E. for a second? I have a quick question for you. Looking at this movie, and I've seen about 40 minutes of it, I couldn't help but think I was watching like an action-adventure version of Mad Men.
Because it was a period movie?
Yeah, I don't know. I just kind of thought to myself, I wonder if audiences are over that whole like 1960s Mad Men era look.
Audiences are never over anything. All they're over is movies that aren't good. And they'll see bad movies even if you can trick them. But if you make a bad movie it doesn't matter what era it's set in or what genre it's in. If you make a good movie, it doesn't matter. You can reach people with a Western musical. It doesn't, you know, there's no, audiences don't get tired of things. They like good movies.
Look, you know, I think you need to call Fox.
I don't think they said, oh, that looks like it's a 1960s film. I'm not in the mood for a 1960s period action film. That's not how life works, is it?
Probably not, no.
That's what the studios want to tell themselves when something flops. They want an excuse, a reason, an explanation. Oh, we can't make movies set in the 60s anymore.
But let me ask you this. Can you call 20th Century Fox and explain to them how to trick people into seeing a bad movie? Because it did not work for Fantastic Four.
That's true. The Fantastic Four did not do well. Like I said, I don't think this is an issue of second guessing. They tried it. They did everything right. They hired a cool young director, edgy script, young, smart cast. It just didn't come out well.
All right.
But it worked well for Mr. Tumor.
Yeah.
This is a Chinese drama called Go Away, Mr. Tumor. It grossed $21 million over the weekend. I guess it opened on a Wednesday because it's at $29 million and counting. This is a Chinese tearjerker about a cartoonist who gets cancer.
And actually, there's a sequel starring Arnold Schwarzenegger that is, it's not a tumor.
All right. Number six
is Minions. That's a Kindergarten Cop joke. I just put in a Kindergarten Cop joke. Come on.
At number six is Minions, which grossed another $20 million. That's at $960 million worldwide. Clearly, that's going to hit the $1 billion mark, another huge success story for Universal. At number seven is Veteran. This is the Hong Kong drama we talked about. I think somebody in Hollywood must have optioned this movie already, right? You got a veteran cop targeting a one percenter obnoxious kid who's, you know, doing evil things, but gets away with it because he's rich and powerful. It seems tailor-made for Hollywood.
Wait, wasn't Edward Norton in that movie? In the 90s? What? No, this is a different movie. Never mind.
It grossed $18 million over the weekend, and it's at $44 million and counting. Adam Sandler's not having a good week either. Pixels made another $15 million. It's at $160 million worldwide. It didn't cost a lot to make, right? $80, $90 million? They're looking to get to $250. So, you know, it's in 81 territory, so it's pretty fully played out. I don't know if it's opened in China. I don't know if there's a big territory left. That's a little hard for us to track. You know, it certainly is not going to make money. It probably won't get to $250. But, you know, again, he's a movie star. It grosses $200 million with dreadful, dreadful reviews.
And a dreadful movie, apparently, but yeah.
That's what I mean by dreadful reviews, yeah.
Yeah.
On the other hand, there's Inside Out.
Hey, you know, Amy Pascal said she liked the movie. I know we said that last week, but you know, just as a reminder, Amy Pascal loved Pixels. Moving on.
Inside Out, why does it say Universal next to it?
It should not.
Oh, that's for international. So Universal is distributing internationally?
Maybe, yeah. No, that can't possibly be right.
That can't possibly be right. So, you know, RentTrack is a great source, but you always got to think about, you can't take anything for granted. We're looking at the listing
especially the way we paste these into our show notes.
Well, yeah. Oh, you did it, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
Did you not do that side of the screen?
I did do that column, but who knows what happened.
Well, it says Disney domestically, and it's the only Disney thing listed. So it's a little confusing here. It says that Universal is distributing this Pixar film overseas. That can't be right. Disney would have that movie worldwide.
Oh, yes.
So you always got to keep in mind where your information is coming from, think about the movie. You know, got to use your common sense when taking in data from other people.
But this is the devil movie, I tell you.
It's at $666 million worldwide. It is the mark of the devil.
That's right. It's a great movie. Go see it.
And so hopefully next week it will pass that and no longer be Satan's, you know, hell child.
In fact, my kids still haven't seen this movie. Today, I'm going to find... No, because it's been the summer and things have been going on. I'm going to find out if it's still playing. I want to take them to see it.
It's a Jurassic World.
I did not take them to see that. Okay, no, I did, actually. You're right. I didn't take them to see it twice or three times like some people I know who decided to take them again and again. But I guess if your grandparents, you need something to do with them. And Jurassic World was it.
So Pixar. Mm-hmm.
But Inside Out is definitely worth seeing. In my opinion.
All right. It's the Pixar film. It's grossed $340 million in North America, more than it has overseas yet. This is just a monster hit in the U.S. It really has made a ton of money. It's Pixar's second or third biggest movie of all time. I think it's past Finding Nemo by now.
Well, just to give you some sense, I just looked up showtimes around my area. It is playing at the 16plex, the AMC 16plex, right around the corner. Well, not around the corner, but down the street here. And usually by now, if a film had played itself out,
one screening a day, noon or something.
Yeah, it wouldn't even be there. It would not. But it has 1, 2, 3, 4 showings. It doesn't play past 7, but it's also playing at the Arclight, the big high-end theater. It's got 3 showings. So, you know, it's actually still going well.
It's been in the theaters for 2 months, and it made $2.6 million in North America that weekend. So it's clearly towards the end of its run, $1,900 per screen, but people are still going, and daytime showings make a lot of sense for that movie.
That's right.
At number 10 is Brothers, which is a Hindi remake of the movie Warriors by Gavin O'Connor, which is about like a son and his father, whatever, and he goes into mixed martial arts to get revenge or reclaim the family's name. I never saw the movie, but it made $13 million over the weekend, which is a big, big opening in that market. It's in 9 markets, but it's a very strong opening for an Indian film. At number 11 is the Chinese blockbuster Monster Hunt, another $11 million. It's at $350 million worldwide, the highest grossing Chinese language film in that country's history. Ant-Man, is that a hit? It's just about there.
I was just about to ask you, I said, do you think this movie's a hit? Because it made $350 million almost, and worldwide, it's got to be worth something, right?
Well, it's, you know, they got good reviews. It adds another character that they can bring into the franchise and show in the Avengers movies. It cost $130 million to make. They certainly spent a lot to open it. You know, they didn't scrimp on that. So it's probably not profitable yet, I wouldn't guess. But it is certainly a nice piece of the puzzle. It'll have a nice afterlife. Ant-Man can pop up where he needs to in the Avengers world when he has to play a role. Because, you know, remember, we've got these long, complicated comic books with all these storylines, and you need all these characters. So you do want to introduce Ant-Man, and it's better to do that than, say, the Hulk. You know, none of those worked. So is it more successful than the Hulk? Absolutely.
Well, when the Hulk just says, like, Hulk smash, you know, when you've got, like, 2 lines in your entire, you know, repertoire of dialogue there, yeah, it's a little bit harder. But getting picked to play one of these Marvel comics or in one of these, you know, these Marvel characters must be the equivalent of winning the lottery as an actor, because you know you're going to be called again. Like, you'll always have work at some point in your career.
At least for the next few years.
Yeah. Now let me ask you this about Ant-Man. Is it too late to change the name?
Jurassic World is at $1.6 billion worldwide, thanks to another $10 million over the weekend. Trainwreck, the Amy Schumer film, is at $110 million worldwide. That's looking good. At number 15 is Assassination. This is the South Korean action film we talked about a little while ago. It's about when Japan was occupying Korea and these rebels, these, you know, freedom fighters, targeted the leader of the Japanese troops in a certain city. And they went in on their secret mission to try and take that guy out. And they're led by a woman who is the greatest sharpshooter in history. That made $7 million over the weekend, and it's at $71 million and counting. Vacation, that certainly has not done well. It's sort of tanked here in North America. Tanked isn't the right word. It's made $50 million, and it only costs $30 million to make. We'll have to see how much of a life it has overseas. Does the Vacation name worth something in the rest of the world?
Yes, everybody wants to take one.
It is a comedy, which historically we're supposed to think doesn't travel well, but maybe those movies did a lot of money overseas. Maybe they have name brand value, or maybe just, you know, Ed Helms and The Office, and who knows?
Well, right underneath that is a movie that normally we may not even talk about, right? The Gift. But this movie did not cost very much to make, and it's doing quite well.
Well, they picked it up for like $2 million and change. It's a thriller horror film, not a horror film, but a thriller stalker type film, right? Starring Jason Bateman. And they've grossed $26 million here in North America. The question is, how much money did they spend to promote it? Probably not a ton, right?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's SFX Entertainment, and I can't imagine that
it's on 2,500 screens. And by the way, now when a movie opens in less than 4,000 screens, they say a modest number of screens. Like Straight out of Compton, they said opened up on a modest 2,700 screens. Is that modest? You can make all the money in the world on 2,700 screens.
Yeah, well, I mean, and it was directed by Joel Edgerton, who is an Australian actor, and I guess he's doing some directing, and I'm sure he probably started out as a director. I don't know, but this is, you know, it's one of those Blumhouse productions. Jason Blum, the producer, he specializes in making films that cost very, very little but gross a lot, so very genre-specific films.
That's right. Speaking of movies that don't cost a lot, you have Meryl Streep's film Ricky and the Flash. That's in its ninth week? Is that right? I don't think you cut and pasted these right. I'm going to do that next week.
And here I thought right. I was doing you a favor. I was like, look, I'm going to help Michael out. I'm going to cut and paste these completely wrong.
That grossed $4.5 million over the weekend. It's at $15 million in counting, but it had a nice hold. And of course, the audience for that film is a more adult. They're not going to rush out on opening weekend. So it had a good hold, reviews, but you know, it may be okay when all is said and done.
Did we get to Shaun the Sheep yet? Because I want to talk about Shaun the Sheep. I haven't seen it, but I just want to talk about it.
My friends are waiting to see it with their kids. They want to see their kids, by the way, in high school. They're not little children. They just like Shaun the Sheep. It's we don't know the budget. We know it's less than $55 million because that was their last movie that from the Aardman folk that did not do great, and it cost more than it should have. This movie is animated, but who knows? Did it cost $30 million? I don't know. It's at $70 million worldwide. If we knew the budget, we could start to talk about whether it's a success or not.
So really,
it's certainly getting great reviews. This is the highest rated film on Rotten Tomatoes.
So really, this show is not only about Star Wars, it's about sheep. We should actually call it Star Sheep.
And there you go. That's a good idea.
Because we threatened that we were going to talk about Star
I don't
Wars.
Think we have that much Star Wars information, but tell us what happened at Disney D23. And what is D23?
It's basically this convention in Anaheim. Anaheim has a very big convention center. I guess they built it because, hey, there was this like thing that the families could do while, you know, there was a convention going on. You could send them across the street, literally, to Disneyland. And so there's this big convention hall.
It's like
there.
Vegas. Why do we have shopping?
Because there's tons of hotels where people are making money on the casinos, you may as well let them spend it across the street. So, you know, they decided a couple of years ago, let's skip this Comic-Con thing. We have so much going on that, and we have such a huge fan base and a loyal following. We could do our own convention every year, invite everybody from all over the world to it, bring out all of our stars, bring out all of our princesses, literally, and you know, show them to the fans. And oh, by the way, maybe they can go to Disneyland while they're here.
And it's not really about replacing Comic-Con. I mean, Disney has theme parks and TV shows, and I mean, it's a huge different audience, perhaps, than the people who go to Comic-Con.
I think you're right. I mean, some of it is overlap, but I think there are.
It started in 2009. Of course, there's an overlap because now they own Marvel and they own Star Wars. But
right.
They were doing this in 2009 when they didn't. I don't think they did own Marvel and Star Wars. You know, they have people who go to their parks every year, multiple times a year. They have people who are obsessed with their merchandise and obsessed with the, you know, the animation history and all that stuff.
Well, I go to Disneyland at least once a year, not because I'm a big fan, but because it's right, you know, it's in Anaheim. It's an hour away, not even. And the kids like to go. They love to go.
Sure.
And you run into these people who you can tell they have the season pass.
They got the wristband.
They don't even live anywhere near Anaheim. They live further away than I do, and they have a season pass. And yeah, they have the wristbands. They have the lanyards with the buttons from everywhere and the pins, the trading pin. I mean, they are Disney fanatics. They've got the T-shirt from 20 years ago. It's pretty remarkable.
Yeah, but to explain here, we're talking about them holding an event where they tell you about new stuff that they're going to sell you. And
yeah.
People pay and travel to go and listen.
That's
right. Can you imagine I'm going to show you some commercials. Please come to Florida and we will show you commercials. Travel to New York so we can show you ads for our upcoming product.
Well, I believe they call that.
Yes, please.
Yeah. I believe they call that the upfronts. in television.
Well, this is the public we're talking about.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, no, we're talking about people in your home. Imagine companies that could just say, hey, come here. We're going to tell you about our new stuff. How many people would show up?
None.
For Warner Brothers?
DC, maybe. DC Comics. They do. Yeah. It's called Comic-Con.
I'm saying a company on their own saying, we got product to show you. Come on in.
Casablanca.
Travel to our company. Travel to our headquarters so we can tell you about the new stuff we're going to sell you.
Yeah, probably none. Actually.
You think if a TV network did that the audience would show up? Do you think if they said, we're going to tell you about our new fall shows, that people, regular TV watchers, would go?
Other than the NFL draft, probably not.
Okay. So what happened at D23? What did they say about Star Wars?
Well, they basically said, we're going to rename the company Star Wars and forget Disney. We're going to open Star Wars Land, which was a big shock to everybody. Nobody saw this coming at all. Nobody had predicted this 50 times or for the last 5 years. It was since Disney purchased Lucasfilm in 2012. Nobody had predicted that this would happen.
Right. They announced not just that there'd be a Star Wars Land in Florida and California, but there'd also be an Avengers Land. They're still building Avatar Land.
I don't know about the Avengers Land thing. I did not see that. I kept looking for that and I couldn't find it.
I thought they announced that there would be Avengers stuff.
No, they actually, it was notably absent. There was no Avengers Land stuff.
Oh, I must have looked at a bad headline or gotten some bad information. And they are doing Toy Story. Is that a land or is that just like ride?
That is a land. Now, all of these new areas of their theme parks are going to be what they refer to as immersive, meaning like Cars Land. When you go into Cars Land at California Adventure, I think it's California Adventureland.
Isn't Frontierland immersive? What do you mean by immersive?
Yeah, Frontierland is a perfect example of that, where you go in and it is... Yeah,
it's a land. You feel like you're in the land, right?
Yes.
Right, like all their other ones that they've ever done. You're in Tomorrowland, you feel like you're in Tomorrowland. You feel like you're in whatever. Yeah, that's what they do.
Yeah.
It's not new.
Well, I mean...
You don't want to be in Avatar Land and see, you know, Spider-Man.
Well, when you go into Cars Land, it really is like you stepped into this whole other world. I don't know how they did it, but literally everything in there is just cars. There's Flo's Diner and Luigi's Tire Shop. I mean, it's really cool.
And is there any risk? I guess you can always redo a land after 20, 30, or 40 years. I mean, you've had Star Wars around for 40 years. You've had the Avengers around and Marvel around for 50 years. So if and when they do that, that won't be a huge risk. Cars Land is a little bit of a risk, but it's Cars, right?
You could always redo it.
Cars work even if you don't care about the franchise, right? Avatar, that to me seems the riskiest one.
Yes,
I agree. One movie that even isn't very good, and they're devoting an entire land to that world. That to me is where they're really going out on a limb, don't you think?
Yes.
And if you launched Matrix Land after the first Matrix film, how would you feel?
Not good.
Right.
Not good at all.
Do I think the next two or three Avatar movies are going to bomb and be awful? Well, you know, I'm sure they'll make money. Almost every movie he's ever made has made money. Thank you, James Cameron, says Hollywood. But nonetheless, I think that is an unwise choice.
Well, I don't know. Look at Terminator 9 or whichever one they're up to now. How well did that do?
Not great.
Okay, there you go. That answers your question.
Well, but is there a Terminator ride at Universal Studios, isn't there, or one of those parks?
I think it's Universal, yes.
It's a difference between having a ride and an entire land.
Yeah, look, you know, yesterday I was at Barnes & Noble with my kids, and something dawned on me. They're in the kids section looking up, you know, whatever they were looking at, Harry Potter books or whatever, and I'm standing there looking at a full table, a whole wing full of Star Wars books, toys, merchandise, no action figures, but I mean, backpacks. And I just thought to myself, well, I guess maybe this company was worth $4 billion. This, you know, the last movie came out over 10 years ago, and it's as if the movie just opened. And it's not as if they're putting this up because, oh, gee, there's a movie coming out in December. They've had this all the time. They mm-hmm. have Star Wars merchandise.
There's been like hundreds of books. You know, if you're talking about like actual hardcover extensions of the world, forget all the little tiny paperback spinoff stuff, you know, which is just merchandising. But actual novels set in the Star Wars world, we're into the hundreds now, I believe. The bestsellers, you know, since the 70s.
Yes.
Written by multiple authors. So, you know, there's a whole huge, you know, wealth of information to draw upon when you want to build a land or a world or make new movies. And we've got Star Wars movies for the next 5 years, right? Episode 7 is this fall. episode, then you've got Rogue One spinoff, then episode 8, then you've got Han Solo, then you've got episode 9, then you've got Boba Fett. I mean, you know, they're not going to go anywhere.
Boba Fett, there will be no, it's going to be a silent movie.
That's right.
Now, I guess episode 9.
There was also directing information, wasn't there?
Yeah, episode 9 got a director, right?
That's right. Who is?
Colin Trevorrow.
That's right. The director of Jurassic World. What a shock.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, Steven Spielberg handpicked him to do Jurassic World. And so I guess it makes sense that he shouldn't get Star Wars necessarily, but it makes sense that he would have the skill set to handle such a movie.
Yeah, I mean, and there's a Toy Story Land, and of course, that's just three movies and some TV spinoffs and lots of merchandising, but it's also a cowboy, an astronaut. You know, it's classic toy characters that are iconic regardless of the property itself.
Yes,
you don't need an explanation about a cowboy. You don't need an explanation about an astronaut, you know? And they've endured for, what is it? We're talking at
1995.
So 20 years now.
Yes.
So it's a little bit out there. But again, yeah, with all the classic characters that are in Toy Story, if you've got the rights to them, like a Slinky dog, that too. To me, that also seems like less of a risk. But theme parks are where there's lots of money. And they did it with Harry Potter, didn't they? But that too, you had 7 books, massive movies, one of the biggest phenomenon of all time. Avatar is the highest grossing film of all time, but somehow it still feels like you're much more out on a limb.
Yes, I would agree. Now, you mentioned Harry Potter. My kids are reading these books now, and they love them. They are referencing them all the time, and I just think to myself, what is it about those books? They're like catnip for kids.
Well, not kids, everybody.
Okay, well, they're like catnip for humans.
Well, what do you mean? They're well-written and entertaining.
Okay. I like them, but, you know.
There's no secret.
But you'd think,
you know,
like,
why does Alice in Wonderland endure? Why does, you know?
I don't know, but they're not reading, you know, Nancy Drew that way.
Well, Nancy Drew still sells a lot.
I know, I'm just saying.
Okay. So Disney's out on the limb with Avatar, and I feel like the big roll of the dice on Broadway was Hamilton. Not the fact that they were taking it to Broadway, but the fact that they waited. The producers behind Hamilton, this is the new hip-hop musical about the founding fathers, they wanted to rush to Broadway right away. They'd open it to the public, rave reviews, sold out audiences, everybody was excited. They would have been the front runner for the Tony immediately. And the creator, Lin-Manuel Miranda, and the other people involved were like, no, we need to take a break. We're exhausted. We want to work on it. We want to make it better. We know we can improve it. We want to wait. And they're like, no, don't wait. Never wait. This is your moment. But they waited. And now they opened in August, which means it's about 9-8 months before the next Tony Awards. And so they have to hope that they'll still be the hot show then. They, you know, they took a little break. Maybe people would have gotten bored. No, it worked out, didn't it?
Yeah, well, they're making $1.3 million during a preview week leading into the opening, I should say. But I really feel like I can't talk about this show, not because I haven't seen it, but because I've already mucked up a whole bunch of other news relating to hip-hop, rap, and this particular
genre. Well,
luckily,
it's not a hip-hop thing you have to talk about. It's just a Broadway musical.
Okay.
It uses hip-hop as well as, you know, R&B and girl group sounds and Brit pop. So it is not, you know, this is not the blueprint put on Broadway. This is a Broadway show. It's, in fact, it's got a lot more in common with Sunday in the Park with George than it does with the Notorious B.I.G.
Well, since
that
I just
paid.
That is
my take on it. And if you want to read my review, of course you do.
We've got
links in the show notes.
Where is it? It's on the Huffington Post. That's right.
Yeah. And we have the links in our show notes.
Okay. Oh, yes. I see them there. Now, I should say this darn well better not be Sunday in the Park with George, because I just paid my kid's college tuition for tickets to this thing.
What's wrong with Sunday in the Park with George?
Nothing. But, you know, it takes a certain kind of taste. You have to like Stephen Sondheim, number one.
You have to have taste is what you're saying.
Yes. And apparently I do have taste because I just paid a fortune for these tickets.
No, it's really good. You'll have a good time.
Well, what I can't wait for, and not only Hamilton, but I can't wait for this new musical that is based on a 2007 film called Waitress. Do you see what I did there? I said I can't wait, and the name of the show is Waitress.
There you go.
Do you see what
there
I
you
did?
Go. Keep going. Why are you excited? You love the movie? The sad story behind it? What is it?
Well, I actually did see the movie, and I did like it, actually. It was a Sundance film, and I saw it at Sundance. And it's going to open next year, the musical. It will open in the spring at the Brooks Atkinson Theater. Right now, it's at the American Repertory Theater in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And there's something interesting going on here. Sarah Bareilles, who is a singer-songwriter, kind of a pop singer-songwriter, she is going to be doing the music and the lyrics for this show. And given the...
She has done. It's playing out of town.
That's
true. I mean, I'm sure they're working on them more, but yeah.
Yeah, so she's already... She's actually living in Cambridge, Massachusetts for the run of that out-of-town run. And she's working on the show, so I'm interested to see how it comes off.
Are you a Sarah Bareilles fan?
You know, I kind of forgot who she was until I read this story and I listened to some of the music. I'm like, oh, yeah, I kind of do know her. And her music is very fitting for... for musical theater. So I'm interested to see how it translates. Unlike, say, U2, where it did not translate at all.
Well, this is, you know, a high-profile production. Diane Paulus is directing. Jesse Mueller, who won the Tony for Beautiful, the Carole King musical, is starring in this production. So, you know, it's a blue-chip production, just like Hamilton was when it came from the public. But Broadway is really... really firing on all cylinders. They have had a string of successful shows opening up within the last year and a half, that all look like they're going to be here for, you know, 2-3 years to come. And if you run for 2.5 years, you will hit 1,000 performances, and that means you are among the longest running shows in Broadway history. So 2.5 years is a really long time, and I don't know if there's any show on this list that we've got that I don't think will hit that. I think they'll all hit 1,000. Aladdin. Disney's Aladdin opened up. It was a hit from day one, but it has continued to grow. Clearly, word of mouth is great. Families are loving it. Disney knows how to price it. It's now making more than $2 million. It made $2 million the last 2 weeks in a row, and it beat Wicked 2 weeks in a row. I mean, this has turned in from a big smash hit into an absolute blockbuster. It's now up there with the big four. You've got The Lion King, Wicked, The Book of Mormon, and now Aladdin.
And what about Hamilton?
Well, Hamilton is moving up there too. Hamilton and Book of Mormon are both in much smaller houses. They both have about 10,000 seats. Book of Mormon has priced itself through the roof.
10,000 seats across a week.
Yes.
Okay, yes.
As opposed to like 15 or 20, which you have for some of these others, which are much bigger houses. So Book of Mormon has said, yeah, you know what? We're a really small house. Guess what you're going to pay? A lot of money. So they really charge through the roof for their tickets. That's why they're up there in their grosses. Hamilton has much more modest numbers as far as the top ticket price. So we'll have to see, you know, long term, it's going to run for years.
Hamilton has modest prices. Boy, I'd like to be living your life.
It does. $275 is the top ticket price. Book of Mormon is $450. Other shows have $375, $350. Hamilton could charge $1,000 and make it right now, but that would not be wise long term. And they don't want the bad press and the bad thing, and they want it to run a long time. And they've figured out, yeah, we don't want to stick it to people with our top ticket price. And
let the scalpers do that. No, by the way, they are.
Well, but you know, there's ways to get around that, and I wish they'd do more of it. You know, to get around scalpers, you know.
Yeah.
If you sell a ticket, you'd have to bring your ticket and your ID to the box office to get it. You wouldn't have any scalpers.
True.
None. But they make money on the secondary market without having the embarrassment of charging $500.
No, they sell directly to the second market, and that's one way to do that.
Right, exactly. So, you know, Hamilton is a big smash hit. It's going to run for a long time to come. But what matters is not, just like in Hollywood box office, you don't care who's number one, who's number two, how much did Hamilton make versus Book of Mormon. It's not a competition. What matters is how much it costs your show to make, how much it costs to run each week, and how much you're making. Hamilton is blowing, you know, through the roof. It's got a big cast. I'm sure it costs $700,000-$800,000 a week, but it's doing great. It's making $1.2 million this week. So that means it grossed, you know, it netted $400,000. So, you know, every week it's going to keep doing that for a long time to come. But Aladdin and Hamilton are not the only big hits. Aladdin opened up last March. This March we had An American in Paris, Fun Home, The King and I, Finding Neverland, and Something Rotten all opened this March. All of them are doing terrifically well.
Well, meanwhile, you have An Act of God. This is the comedy starring Jim Parsons at Studio 54, and Penn and Teller on Broadway, both of which have made their money back. They've recouped their capitalization, as they say. One in 10 weeks. And they
both cost about $3 million to make.
Yeah. So,
but they're both limited runs, and they're both sort of very modest. Penn and Teller didn't sell out, but they did really, really well. They were in a big house. But both of them basically, at best, they were going to recoup their money.
Right.
They're recouping their money, and then they're closing a week or two later. So these, to me, are just sort of short-term no-brainers, big brand names that you believe will be able to pack their house for 8 weeks, and then you're done. If something could go wrong, and you could lose money, but basically, you're not risking a lot, and you're not going to lose a lot because they're going to make the money, and you're all going to go home happy. You're not going to make a lot because, they're not running for long enough.
Right.
You know, yeah, Jim Parsons was tearing it up. Penn and Teller did great. They're going back to Vegas where they've been, you know, performing for like 20 years, 30 years, you know. So they came to Broadway with a new show, and now they're back in Vegas again for another 10 years. I'm sure they'll return, but, you know, these are not high-risk things like a big Broadway musical that you hope will run for the next few years. All these shows, these five, six shows just opened in March, they're all doing about as well as you could hope for.
Well, just in case you thought all we cared about were U.S.-based productions on Broadway, we do have some news from across the pond, as they say, on Broadway, or probably...
As we say.
Yeah, everybody says it, actually. Yeah. Here is a show that is opening at the Courtyard Theatre in London and opened last Wednesday. It's a new adaptation of King Lear. It stars only one actor, a man, of course, an actor, and nine sheep. Literally, nine sheep. It's called, in fact, King Lear... with sheep. And it was first staged in London at a London warehouse, I guess, because theaters didn't necessarily want nine sheep traipsing through the backstage there. It opened last summer it then had like a two-night little kind of revival on a farm in Sussex, England, which, by the way, is kind of appropriate given that they're literally live sheep on stage. It was written and directed by Heather Williams, who I guess uses the pen name Missouri Williams because she... I don't know.
Like, she's cool.
Yeah, liked Indiana Jones or something. I'm waiting for her father to show up cool. and say, "We named the dog Missouri." In any case, she was a graduate of Cambridge University, came up with the idea while doing some post-baccalaureate work at Harvard, and everybody at Harvard said, "Yeah, no, we don't like this. This idea is too dirty." I don't know what they meant by that. Maybe they meant, farm dirty.
They meant you don't want to be a stagehand working on this show.
Right, although apparently... Miss Williams says, "Hey, you know what? Actually, the sheep are easy to work with. In fact, they're cheaper than actors."
Yeah, you know, I'd love to see this. It sounds fascinating. I don't know that it's, of course, a male actor. It could be a woman because the character is a director, not a person playing King Lear. It's a director who's trying to stage a production of King Lear with sheep. And when the animals don't cooperate, they start to just perform the whole show themselves. So it could easily be played by a woman.
That's true.
Is it a stunt? Of course. Is it clever? I guess, you know, when we're talking about it. But, you know, it got good reviews. I'm kind of intrigued by the whole idea.
Yeah, I liked what the actor who plays the one actor, Alasdair Saxena, I'm probably butchering that name, but I like what he said about the sheep and working with the sheep. He didn't have any experience in working with farm animals, especially sheep, but he said that the sheep were, quote, remarkably punctual and calm.
Well, there you go. So a lot of hits on Broadway, a lot of sheep in the West End. It's all a big deal.
Oh, then it must be time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines and entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story. Can you tell me how to get to Sesame Street? You see the Shakespearean delivery I just gave you?
Very nice. Very nice. Keep going.
Well, I actually can tell you, by the way, how to get to Sesame Street. You go two blocks and take a right onto HBO. In fact, yep, the iconic children's TV show is headed to pay giant HBO. No, it's not abandoning public television, but Sesame Street has been essentially self-funded for decades, with PBS covering just 10% of the cost of making the show. Money for that came from licensing and DVD sales and the like, and now that kids are watching streaming video, the money is drying up. In steps HBO, they've made a deal for the next 5 years. HBO gets new episodes, which will air on PBS 9 months later. They also get a Sesame Street Muppet spinoff, an original series, and will license back episodes of other shows like Electric Company. Duh.
Am. It's Electric Company.
Okay. I get it now.
And never mind.
Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal, and it's probably not a great deal. I don't think it's bad as far as the deal itself. HBO, that's fine. You know, we're helping out. It's good. They're doubling the number of episodes from 18 a year to 35. It's unclear to me when they stopped making hour-long episodes because these are going to be half-hour episodes. And it's not clear to me whether they were making 18-hour-long episodes and now they're going to make 35 half-hour episodes, which to me means you're just chopping your 18 episodes in half. I think, but I'm not clear, that they had reduced the number of episodes and the length a little while ago, and that they were half an hour for new episodes, and now they're going to double that number. So they are actually increasing the number of hours that there will be of Sesame Street. So that's good. I'm not quite sure why there'd be a decline in licensing. We know that DVD sales have bottomed out. We know that 2/3 of kids watch Sesame Street on demand somewhere. like streaming or apps or YouTube. So that's, you know, they're not watching in front of the TV when it airs. They're watching it when they want to. So that's affecting how they consume the show, but it's not affecting the money that's coming in. But for a while now, the company that makes Sesame Street, it used to be called Children's Television Workshop. It's a nonprofit company devoted to education. They've been losing money for a little while. They got in new bosses, people who were at Nickelodeon, and their whole focus, unfortunately, has been, we got to make lots of money. You know, they are about monetizing and making lots of money. And of course, you don't want to lose money because that threatens the long-term health. But they fired a lot of people. They fired writers. They fired puppeteers. They're just firing people left and right. And it's their emphasis is very scary and very sad for the future long-term health creatively of this whole project and this whole world.
Yeah, I noticed that both, objectively, both the New York Times, LA Times, Wall Street Journal, so all three kind of mentioned the they didn't say it directly, but they said, and now a quote from the head of Children's Television Workshop, who is brand new. He's been there for a year. They kind of were both all implying, hey, this guy's been there for a year and now this.
Yeah.
So,
well, but this deal is not the problem.
No, it's not.
The issue of, you know, saying, all right, we're making less on merchandising and licensing. We need to find a new way to fund our shows. HBO steps in. Kids get to see them everywhere, no matter what. There's 1,000 episodes of Sesame Street. So it's not important that you see new episodes every minute of the day anyway. It's always good to have fresh content. But this sounds like a win-win to me, this particular deal. But the overall thrust of the company once known as Children's Television Workshop, that is what is concerned. When they're getting rid of people who've been there for decades and are the heart and soul of the place, the writers, the puppeteers, the artists, and getting rid of them and dumping them and saying, hey, well, we can make a big movie, you know, then I'm worried.
Well, speaking of companies once known as, Columbia House, the mail order company that sold you 8 CDs for a penny, has filed for bankruptcy, causing no end of joy, I'm sure, to many people who had to call and send back their CDs. to which the only responsible response is Columbia House was still around, of course. That was the other response. The company made money by giving you a pile of CDs up front and then sent you monthly newsletters and automatic picks until you had purchased an additional 10 or 12 or so and fulfilled your quote-unquote agreement. At its peak, they made $1.4 billion a year. The company.
Wow. Yeah. I would never have guessed that.
That was, by the way, in 1996. Last year, they made, get this, $17 million in revenue. That's a far cry from $1.4 billion. the company blames this little thing. You may have heard of it. It's called streaming. Naturally. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop, of course. And it's not streaming of music, it's streaming of video that they blame, because Columbia House had switched over basically in 2010 to DVDs.
That's
right. Stopped selling CDs. By the end, they still had 110,000 members, people who said, give me 4 DVDs and I'll buy 4 more, or whatever the deal was. I don't know. But yeah, you know, it's the overall industry. In 2000, they sold $13 billion worth of CDs in America. Last year, they sold $1.8 billion of CDs. You know, that's $11 billion less. So yeah. There's a lot fewer people buying CDs or buying DVDs and all this world. So, of course, it's coming to an end. Look at the number one album in the country, the Disney Channel soundtrack, Descendants, hit number one on Billboard. It sold the equivalent of 42,000 copies. It hit number one selling 40. You couldn't get in the top 100 once upon a time selling 42,000 copies. I mean, that is just, and they actually only sold 30,000 copies. The rest were streaming. It's the lowest total in history. So the same thing is happening to DVDs that has been happening to CDs. People are not buying them anymore.
Yeah, it used to be that if you were a band, you know, kind of like one of those, you know, up and coming bands that nobody had heard of, and you were trying to get a song on the radio, if your album in its first year sold 40,000 copies, you were considered a hit. I mean, nobody may have heard of you, but if you sold 40,000 copies of your album, you were, you know, the record company would keep you around, would continue your contract. Now, of course, you know, forget about selling 42,000 copies or 40,000 copies to Jermaine. Hey, you're lucky if you sell 5.
Exactly.
Is Al Swearingen ready to swear again? The iconic character from HBO's Deadwood might just have new life. Now that Timothy Oliphant has wound up his hit series Justified, he's free. Ian McShane has a recurring role in the new season of Game of Thrones, but heck, those characters die all the time, don't they? So if Entourage can spin off a feature film, surely Deadwood could too, right? And is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I think it's a big, not good idea. That's for sure.
I have no idea what you just said. There were so many words in there. I think you're saying it's a bad idea.
That's right.
Okay.
I'm not sure why you'd want to make a feature film. Doing one more season? You know?
I don't know. Yeah, just do one more
season. Six episodes, eight episodes. I think that's the proper way to do it.
Yeah.
That's the proper way to do it. I think a feature film, fine. You know, better than nothing. But that show is so rich that I don't see why they would do it that way. But maybe they'll plan it out to have, you know, a movie and have a sequel or two sequels if it works, or maybe they'll, I don't know. It just seems like it was a great show and you needed 10 hours to tell the story. Why suddenly do you want to finish it up in two?
The New York Times ran an extensive feature on Sunday detailing miserable working conditions at Amazon. And I don't mean the Amazon rainforest, I mean the website where we buy everything. It wasn't focused so much on low-level employees working at the warehouses, but the overall corporate culture and shark-like attitude of aggressively moving forward or die, a philosophy they say comes from the top. Work nights, work weekends, work holidays, and if you ever take time off for any reason, you're not a true blue employee. In fact, if you don't come to work on Saturday, don't bother coming in on Sunday. Amazon's Jeff Bezos responded in a letter to his fellow Amazonians saying that anyone who stayed at a company like the one the New York Times described would have to be crazy. And then he quit. No. He said the Times was wrong, actually. This is the latest black eye for the massive corporation. Big deal or big whoop?
Big whoop.
No, okay.
Right, it's PR. You get bad PR at Walmart, you get bad PR at Amazon, nobody cares. They're going to just keep doing what they do. Is it going to make somebody quit their company? Is it going to make somebody stop buying their product or their stock? Nope.
Now, I have applied, in all full disclosure, I have applied several times to work at subsidiaries of Amazon, not Amazon directly.
Have you?
Yes, have gone down their little interview chain, if you will. It was very, very interesting. And the more I kind of got it to the final picks, in a way, I don't want to say I sabotaged it myself, but I could sense, wow, I don't know if I want to work here. This is really crazy. Like, some of the stuff that I was being told and the vibe that I was getting was exactly what the New York Times article was highlighting.
Like, this is your life. You will have no other life. This is your life.
And, oh, by the way, part of the this is your life is here is the corporate, here are the corporate obstacles and hurdles that you will have to contend with. That will drive you insane and that you will spend a lot of your time contending with rather than doing the job that you were hired to do. Yeah, I mean, very, by the way, what I did note was that everybody I dealt with over there was wicked smart. Everybody was really, really, really smart at the top of their game.
Mm-hmm. Were they unhappy? Did they cry?
No, only when I hit them, actually.
All right.
Okay.
Moving on.
Here's Johnny. Yes, Johnny Carson is back. The little-known cable channel Antenna, which I tried to find on my cable lineup there. It has a lineup of evergreens like Father Knows Best and Leave It to Beaver. Antenna will begin airing full episodes of The Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson weeknights at 11 p.m. starting in January. You know why? We don't have enough late-night talk show hosts right now. They'll be grouped in themes like a week devoted to debuts of famous comics or musical guests or anniversaries of movies or performers and the like. You get it. So watch out, Jimmy Fallon. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop, of course.
What?
And the reason it happened, it's reruns of a show from 40 years ago. But, you know, the thing that's interesting is that they made a deal. You know, the deal for this almost fell apart, of course, over rights issues. They had to negotiate with the American Federation of Musicians and the talent guilds. It took them 6 months. It almost fell apart. Nobody's ever tried to rerun a variety or chat show before like this. You know, that's what Carol Burnett was invisible for decades. You just couldn't see it. And, you know, it's crazy. Of all these TV shows and movies, it's taking them 30, 40 years to realize, yeah, maybe we should do a deal where they can actually air them and we can make some money rather than having, like, the Wonder Years be invisible for, you know, 20 years, rather than have the Carol Burnett show disappear entirely. You know, like, now that, you know, people are not watching cable anymore, they've finally woken up and realized that their ridiculous negotiations that just keep this stuff off the air isn't helping anyone.
You know who it helps,
Why
actually?
Why did it take 30 years?
Because you know who it helps, and this is part of the problem, is it helps the lawyers negotiating these deals.
No, because no deals were happening.
Yes,
there were no deals. Nobody wasn't even trying to put on any reruns of variety shows or talk shows or stuff. Like, nobody tried. Nobody was desperately hitting their head against the wall. Lawyers weren't raking up hours. It just wasn't happening. TV shows like The Wonder Years and Northern Exposure and any show with music, WKRP, which took ages to get onto DVD, because of all the rights issues. That's not helping anybody. They just weren't happening.
Speaking of things that may not happen.
Oh, my God.
The mother of all Kickstarter campaigns has begun. And when I say the mother of all Kickstarter campaigns, get this. A group of architects and Tolkien enthusiasts, they have launched a $3 billion project. You did not hear me incorrectly. It's a $3 billion project. They want to build a working city in the United Kingdom based on Minas Tirith. And I know I just pronounced that wrong, didn't I, Michael?
Minas Tirith.
Yeah, I knew the Tirith part was wrong. It's not a tourist attraction as such, but an actual city where people would live and work and be slaughtered by orcs and goblins and stuff, right? I mean, that's what would happen, right?
Keep going.
Oh, well. Of course, they would make money off of all the tourists, of course. They're basing plans on the city as depicted in Peter Jackson's The Lord of the Rings movies, and the project would be completed by 2023, assuming Smaug doesn't interfere with construction. Big deal or big whoop?
Oh, my God. This is a joke. This was covered by the rap as if it's serious. It is a joke. They're not serious. They have a note in the Kickstarter thing saying, you know, please be aware this is a lighthearted adventure with virtually no chance of succeeding. They're not serious. They've raised $30,000. You know, it's a joke. And they did a news story on it. I don't know who else covered this, as if it was actually a viable, real thing because it's on Kickstarter.
I put this in for you, the Lord of the Rings fan.
It's ridiculous that the rap would cover this as if it's an actual thing. It's a joke. People put stuff on eBay. I'll sell you the air from whatever. It's a joke. You know, fine if you want to report it as a joke, but they reported it dead seriously.
Well, you know, that's what happens when you've got a blog and you need like 20 stories a day.
Ugh, ridiculous.
But that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. This week, we kind of have a story where, look, it's August, okay? And nothing's supposed to be happening. And this is kind of like nothing is happening. But there is a company out there called SFX Entertainment. And the reason anybody talks about this company is because Robert F.X. Sillerman is a part of it. And if that name sounds familiar, it's because Sillerman, he started all of these companies. He did these roll-ups of all these, and this is back in the 80s and 90s. He became a big deal in the music business by rolling up concert promoters nationally and turning them into what ultimately became Clear Channel and what ultimately became Live Nation.
Don't they talk about SFX because it's a big player in the concert business?
And now they talk about SFX, yes, because it is a very big player in the concert business. It is one of the big concert promoters, much like Live Nation, much like AEG. This company is, especially when it comes to electronic dance music, EDM festivals, a very big player. In fact, they actually their revenue went up by 50%, but somehow they still managed to lose $48 million over the last 6 months.
So what is going wrong with them? I understand the stock market price, the company's in play, people are fleeing it, they had a bad quarter, but why suddenly? Their focus was on the electronic music festivals. That was really their game. Is that slowing down and not maintaining the same pace? Did they expand too fast? Do we know what's gone wrong here? Why have the fundamentals changed for SFX?
Well, I think, you know, they went public in, I guess, last year. Was it 20? I can't remember when they went public. But in 2013, they raised $260 million by going public. And I think the problem is that the company is worth less than their stock price. And so now they may be worth more, you know, basically liquidated than they are as a company itself.
Mm. So it's not that there's anything going wrong with the electronic music festival?
Not that I could tell. I think that, you know, certainly there's probably too many of them. And whenever you have too many of something, you know, you get...
And they had venues in Vegas. It just felt wrong for that, you know. It just felt permanent venues in Vegas. It just felt weird.
Yeah, and they're actually making money.
Yeah.
But they're losing it, actually, faster than they can make it. They also have this business where they, you know, they handle... The promotion and marketing for individual artists and concerts. They license concerts.
They want to be 360, right?
Yes, they're trying to do a 360 play because, let's face it, Sillerman has actually done this before, and he always manages to sell out right at the right time. And
this time, not so much.
This time, not so much. In fact, he offered $5.75 a share a while back to buy The company.
Take it private, yeah.
Yeah, he said, okay, look, I'll take it private. I'll take my company private. I'll offer $5.75 a share. He had until last week to actually, you know, come up with the money, or at least prove that he could come up with the money and show how he was going to do it. But he didn't do that. And a lot of people are saying he didn't do that because that $5...
It's too much.
Yeah, they're basically $5.75 a share is now like probably... It's worth
well, 60. It's closed at $2. It's closed at $1.94.
Yeah, so why pay, you know, 500% premium when you could actually buy the whole thing if you bought every share back at $2?
Right.
So that's what's going on in the music business or in the concert industry with SFX Entertainment. That was probably the biggest news from last week. It's not a done deal yet. They're trying to sell the company or find a buyer by October 2nd. We'll see if that happens or whether they kind of tear the company apart and, you know, sell it at a fire sale.
So SFX may be dead.
Oh, in fact, yes, it may be. But unfortunately, we do have some obituaries from this past week. One of whom, if I said the name Uggie to you, do you know?
I would not have known who you meant.
Okay. He is the co-star of The Artist. Now, much like our previous co-stars of King Lear, he did his job on four legs. Four paws, I should say.
He's a dog. He's the Jack Russell from the Oscar-winning film The Artist. Yes.
Okay. That's okay. What I was trying to get at.
Well, why dancer? Why are you being coy? The dog who starred in The Artist died. He was 13 years old. He had prostate cancer. Bless his little heart.
Yes, and he's going to be buried in his trainer's backyard.
Oh, sure, of course. He also appeared in Water for Elephants and probably some other films. He was adorable. He was the best campaigner for an Oscar in ages.
Now you also, yeah, that is true, by the way. He barely said a word. You also have here Billy Sherrill.
Yeah, he's a country artist producer. He's a producer of country music, and he's known for the Countrypolitan sound. He helped popularize that. That was the sort of country music sound where it went from, it was more urban. You had strings, you had hearts, you had a lush production. Patsy Cline sort of embodied that Countrypolitan sound, and he helped bring that into the 70s. He worked with a lot of artists, but especially Tammy Wynette and her husband, on and off, George Jones. So he worked with Tammy Wynette. They co-wrote Stand By Your Man in like 20 minutes. he recorded George Jones doing the Grand Tour and He Stopped Loving Her Today, which are two of the greatest country songs of all time. So he was with George Jones at his peak period creatively. He worked with Tammy Wynette, made her a huge star. He knew how to hold their hands. He knew how to get the best out of them. He's just a big figure in country music, and now he's gone.
Much like we're big figures in the podcasting world.
And now we're gone.
Well, until next week, of course.
That's right. God willing, this will be less than an hour.
Yes. And by the way, hey, hopefully we gave you enough news last week to last you some time.
A lifetime, yeah. Some people would say.
In fact, if you had any complaints about last week's show or corrections from last week or this week or any of our episodes, you can email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. And you know what? Give us a call. We haven't gotten a good phone call in quite a while. 888-567-SAND. That's toll free, 888-567-7263. Give us a call, leave us a voicemail, and we'll play it on at the end of one of these shows here. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You can usually find our show. If you can't find it on one of these podcast aggregators, please give us a call, send us an email, let us know, and we'll correct that issue right away. Please do rate and review the show in those podcast aggregators. It does help us out. Links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find all those ways to contact us and ways to follow us. You can follow us on Twitter, @showbizsandbox is our handle, or you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. You can like our page there. Again, all of that information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their own website, whoismgmt.com. And Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
It's hiphopfordummies.com.
Hey, you know what? I actually need to take that course.
Yeah, that's why I suggested it.
Well, if you can't find any of Michael's writing about the entertainment industry there, why not head on over to michaelgiltz.com, where he kind of aggregates it all, or you can find it on thehuffingtonpost.com, or, you know, he's always on bookfilter.com. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.